This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Andres Contreras reports from his post inside the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa for an update on the continued standoff in Honduras as President Zelaya remains inside the compound. Also, the Palestinian Authority, led by Mahmoud Abbas, reaches a new and disturbing level of complicity with Israel and the U.S. We get striking analysis from Ali Abunima. New revelations on the police murder of Oscar Grant, plus a new biography on the life and work of eco-activist Rod Coronado, and a close look at the struggles inside the environmental movement. And Arnaldo Garcia discusses a new report on growing human rights violations of anti-immigrant policies. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We have been focusing in on the situation in Honduras since a coup government used the military to take the president at gunpoint in his pajamas to the airport and push him out of the country. We have watched this very crucial story unfold. The president returned. Many people, you know, many in the mainstream, AP, Reuters reported that he snuck back into Honduras, like he's some kind of sneak who wasn't elected president in a duly constituted election of the country of Honduras. No, he didn't sneak back. Actually, Andres, what happened is he went back and then he gave a speech from the roof, didn't he?
Right, Dennis. I was right outside the embassy when he gave that speech.
So that he was not hiding. Let me tell you, that's the voice of Andres Contreras. He has been holding out with the president in the Brazilian embassy all these days now, since the president went back proudly to represent his people and stand with the resistance. Andres, there was an OAS delegation in Honduras yesterday. They met with Zelaya and they met with the coup government. One keeps getting the feeling that this is like they're being considered equally.
You're right. And that is quite unfortunate because this coup regime really committed both national and international offenses in taking power and in kidnapping the president and in expatriating him. And it is now the OAS and the United Nations, when this first happened, they had very strong messages of support for President Zelaya, and they did not at all accept any validation from the coup regime itself. But that has evolved now so that here we are, you know, over 3 months later, and things have come pretty much to a stalemate if the negotiation process doesn't move forward. So the OAS did come here yesterday with, you know, five foreign ministers, the general secretary of the OAS, a representative from the United Nations, and several other representatives from other countries, including the United States, with Undersecretary Shannon. And they did meet with Micheletti first of all, and yesterday the negotiation process did take off because both sides named their negotiators, three on each side, and yesterday were the first steps toward that. Now, it's important to point out that President Zelaya did not even get to meet with his negotiators until about 2 hours before the negotiation started. This is one of the complaints that's being basically given to regarding the situation, and the OAS has now agreed that it is a complaint that's very valid.
Now, you say his let me just interrupt. You say his negotiators, you're talking about who? People assigned by the OAS to negotiate on his behalf?
No. President Zelaya has picked three negotiators, two from his government as well as the head of the front, the resistance front. His name is Juan Barahona, and they are his negotiating team. However, he was not permitted to meet with them, his own people, until just prior to the negotiation process beginning. So this is one of the complaints, that the president doesn't have access to people who have information that is important for the process to move forward. And obviously, in this case, access to his own team was not given in a timely basis whatsoever.
Now let me just jump in. I'm sorry. I want people to really understand the situation here. Are you saying that he wasn't allowed to meet with his negotiators because they were kept out of the embassy by the coup government and not let in until the last minute?
Exactly right. That's exactly right. So this happened yesterday. And while they are meeting, this is amazing, while they are meeting, a tear gas attack against protesters nearby affects us all in the embassy. We could all perceive the tear gas while the negotiating team is with the president during this brief time before the negotiation process is to begin. It's just incredible.
So there was actually a security force. There was a coup government military attack or a police attack with tear gas that was felt inside just as the president was meeting with his negotiators, that he was prevented from meeting with until right before the beginning.
That's exactly right, Dennis. And this is, again, there are several other demands in order for the negotiation process to move forward, which has to do not only with the president having access to his negotiation team, but also the demilitarization around the embassy itself, and the reopening of the media that have been shut down, that are opposed to the coup. We're talking about Radio Globo and Channel 36. And these are all demands that actually today were voiced by the OAS representative in a press conference. So they have picked up these demands of President Zelaya, and they are issuing them as their own. But again, the coup regime is not paying attention because, I can very clearly tell you the place around the embassy has not been demilitarized, and the president is not allowed to have other advisors come freely to the embassy. So there's not a lot of good faith in moving forward with this process. One other thing very important to point out is that Micheletti basically told the OAS, when he was meeting with them, a number of things. One is that he said, oh, nothing really changed here in Honduras after June 28th. Everything's pretty much been normal since then, which is absolutely ridiculous. Then another thing he said is that in terms of the negotiation process, he basically had said that he was going to lift the emergency decree. Well, yes, he can do that in words only. However, that has to be published by the Gazette, the official government Gazette. And if it's not published in the Gazette, then the police and the military continue to live as if and act as if the decree is still in force. And this, of course, very much affects the negotiation atmosphere as to whether a dialogue can take place with enough calm, knowing that there's not a state of emergency going on.
Now, in terms of where was you said the OAS delegation met with both sides. Where was the undersecretary? Was he aware of the tear gas and this going on as the negotiation was happening and the preparation? Would he be?
It's hard to know if he knew that it was going on. He probably wasn't. Probably was not aware of it. I don't think the president. Yeah.
Okay. Let me just cut to the quick here, Andres. And one more thing. You were saying just before we went on the air that there are more threatening things happening today. There's this thing with these sort of special kind of motorbikes or motorcycles. What's happening there?
Well, the military and police keep inventing ways of intimidating and harassing. You know, one of their favorite things to do was to march in a whole platoon, banging their shields in front, right in, and walk right in front of the embassy. But today, what happened was that these sort of mountain bike vehicles drove in a very belligerent way right outside the embassy with these armed guards, and it was just a new way to harass us here. So it's a constant psychological warfare that's going on against the embassy, and the president very much gave a report when the 15 members of the OAS were there. He played the recording of the shrieking noise that was used as a weapon against us the morning of the 22nd of September, and he played that for all of the OAS delegation. He showed them photographs of the way that phone calls are interfered with electronic equipment, because a piece of that espionage or whatever kind of equipment was actually captured by security people around President Zelaya. So all of this evidence was shown to the folks who met with the president last night.
That's Andres Canteres. He has been for some time now inside the Brazilian embassy in Honduras. He works with Democracy Now! In Espanol. He's a human rights activist. He's worked with Nonviolence International, and he's helped us here at Flashpoints and the people at Pacifica Radio keep apprised of this very important story, certainly one of the most important stories to come to this region in several decades, and obviously it's important for us to watch it very closely.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Justice delayed is justice denied, reads a statement prepared by 14 Palestinian civil society organizations over the weekend in response to the Palestinian Authority's abandonment of an endorsement of the United Nations Goldstone Report, which calls for an international inquiry into war crimes by Israel. Quote, "It represents the triumph of politics over human rights," the civil society organizations remark. "It is an insult to all victims and a rejection of their rights." According to Ali Abunima of the Electronic Intifada, the quisling leadership of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, headed by Mahmoud Abbas, has, quote, "sunk even lower in its complicity with Israel's occupation of the West Bank and the murderous blockade of Gaza." It was also recently revealed that large contracts with USAID were awarded to companies run by Abbas's sons in the West Bank. In his recent article, Abunima continues, quote, "This latest surrender comes less than 2 weeks after Abbas appeared at a summit in New York with U.S. President Barack Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, despite Obama abandoning his demand that Israel halt settlement construction of Jewish-only settlements on occupied Palestinian land. What makes this even more galling is the real possibility that the PA is helping Israel wash its hands of the blood it spilled in Gaza for something as base as the financial gain of businessmen closely linked with Abbas." Meanwhile, inside occupied Palestine, Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem were beaten and arrested over the weekend when right-wing religious Jewish extremists once again attempted to break into the compound of the Dome of the Rock. Dozens of Palestinian protesters were hurt in the confrontations. And finally, in Gaza, a young Palestinian boy was shot by Israeli forces on his family's farm near the Israeli border in the northern Gaza Strip yesterday. Ashraf Abu Suleiman was shot in the spine. Israeli forces denied ambulances access to the area to take the child to the hospital. Instead, the forces detained him for 2 hours before he was allowed to transfer to a hospital in Israel for medical treatment. Joining us to talk about the current situation in Palestine is our good friend Ali Abunima. Ali is the editor and co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, and he joins us from Chicago. Ali, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Nora.
So let's jump right into this egregious act of complicity and betrayal of international law and the Palestinian people, whom Abbas purports to represent, at least those who live in the West Bank and belong to the business elite. Ali, talk about the significance of the PA's decision to defer recognition of the Goldstone Report and how civil society is reacting to the PA as an essential caretaker of the occupation these days.
Well, it looks and feels like a watershed moment, because the reaction among Palestinians everywhere within Palestine and around the world, and indeed across the Arab world, is one of utter consternation and anger and outrage. And I would say that it's sort of unleashed a lot of pent-up anger about collaboration between the Palestinian Authority and Israel that to some extent has gone unspoken. There's always been a taboo among Palestinians about sort of saying openly that something constitutes collaboration, because it's a very, very painful issue, as in every society. I mean, the French took decades after World War II to be able to talk openly about collaboration with the Nazis, and Palestinians are no different. But the decision of Abbas, apparently under direct American and Israeli pressure, and perhaps influenced by some of these commercial interests you mentioned, seems to have been the last straw. It was a decision to actually work with Israel at the United Nations to defer the Goldstone Report. And the Goldstone Report was really something that had given Palestinians a lot of hope, because here was a very prominent international jurist, Judge Richard Goldstone, the former prosecutor at the UN tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, publishing under UN auspices a 600-page report documenting and confirming and corroborating incontrovertible evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by Israel, and calling for accountability. So the vote in the UN was going to say to the Human Rights Council that this report should be forwarded to the Security Council with the recommendation that further action be taken. And it was particularly shocking for the families in Gaza who lost, some of them, dozens of members. The Al-Samouni family, who lost 29 members in one Israeli attack. Many other families who watched with utter consternation the news that their own so-called government had sabotaged the Goldstone Report and done Israel the greatest possible service by effectively burying it. And the uproar is something that we haven't witnessed in years.
Ali, where does this leave the significance and the impact of the Goldstone Report in terms of holding Israel accountable in an international court of law if the Palestinian Authority doesn't demand that it be looked at all?
Well, there's two aspects to this. There's a legal aspect, which is that the forwarding of the report, to the Security Council has now been delayed, and whether that significantly delays or inhibits the possibility of the report being acted on, I don't know. There probably some international law experts would be better able to understand the process. But the other aspect of it is the political aspect. I think the political significance of the Goldstone Report remains, and it's one measure of it is how terrified the Israelis were of this. And you'll recall that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in his speech to the UN General Assembly, focused much of his attention on the Goldstone Report and attacking it and trying to discredit it. And just this morning in Haaretz, in Yediot HaHararot, there was a report that basically no Israeli top official or military officer can now leave Israel and travel abroad without consulting the Attorney General's office to find out if there's a pending lawsuit against them or an arrest warrant. The news came out that the Israeli Deputy Prime Minister, Moshe Ya'alon, who was a former Israeli army chief, canceled the trip to the United Kingdom because he feared arrest. So the Goldstone Report is another indicator of the sort of steady march of Israeli political and military leaders towards the dock, towards international justice. And I think that remains. The other political aspect of the uproar is that the Palestinian Authority, the U.S. and Israeli-backed Palestinian Authority of Mahmoud Abbas, has lost the last shreds of credibility and legitimacy it had. And I think that creates a new political situation that even the main players in Palestinian politics aren't quite sure how to handle. Hamas is a good example of that. At first, they were sort of making statements, of course, condemning the step that Abbas took, but sort of saying, but, you know, we're still going to go ahead with reconciliation talks, and we still want to come to a sort of power-sharing agreement with the Abbas Authority. I think that's now very much thrown into doubt because Hamas's own credibility will be damaged if they're seen to be doing a deal with Abbas and his clique. And yet Hamas may also feel that they can't afford not to go after a reconciliation. So it creates a very fluid and a very new situation politically.
You are listening to POCC Black Report Radio with the Minister of Information, J.R., on Flashpoints. The videotape police murder of Oscar Grant is still on the minds of many in the Bay Area who watched it on television New Year's night and for 2 weeks after. 9 months later, a date of October 6th has been set for Johannes Meserle, the police trigger man, to plead his case on why his defense team thinks that they need a change of venue for his murder trial. Although Meserle is the only one of five police murderers there that night who has been charged with anything, his defense has been trying to get the charges dropped to no avail. The change of venue hearing is on Tuesday at the Alameda County Courthouse at 1225 Fallon Street in Oakland. The press conference starts at 11:30 a.m. and the hearing begins at 1 p.m. We hope to see as many people as possible there. I sat with Jack Bryson, the father of two sons who were with Oscar Grant on the night that he was murdered, to get an update as well as to hear his reflections on this upcoming murder trial. Jack, recently Meserle's defense team basically were trying to get the charges dropped in the case. Can you give us an update as to what's going to happen in the murder case against Meserle for the murder of Oscar Grant?
Okay, what their lawyer was doing, Michael Raines, he was saying he didn't get a fair pretrial. He said he didn't get to let some witness testify, and he didn't get to let the taser expert testify, and he feels he didn't get a fair trial. So he filed some forms, and he was trying to get the charges dropped.
Since we last spoke and since we last had an update on what we're calling the Oscar Grant case, a number of people have resigned. Can you speak to who some of these people are that have resigned that are very closely connected to this case?
Yeah, Chief G, he has resigned. He said he'll resign in December.
And Chief G being the chief of the BART police.
Correct.
That murdered Oscar Grant.
Correct.
And as well as he's the head of the investigation, right?
Exactly, the cover-up, not the investigation.
You're right.
Yeah, he's in charge of the cover-up, and he still has not done the right thing to fire the rest of the officers. Myers and Nave came out with a report, and it didn't favor what the police officers did. It said that several state and federal laws were violated by these officers, and not one thing they did on that platform was correct. And when that report came out, then Chief G turned around and said he doesn't believe in what that report says, and he still stands by these officers.
What did this report say? Like, can you go more into depth? What is this report? I know it was released a few weeks ago, but what did this report say? And then you said Myers and Nave, that's the public relation firm that they hired, or who is Myers and Nave?
Yeah, they felt that they couldn't get a fair investigation through the BART Internal Affairs. So they hired Myers and Nave to do an investigation. And it came back and it said that nothing that night that these police officers did was right.
Like, for example, give the crowd some...
No leadership, the way they approached the young men. I mean, they should have took each young man one by one and questioned them. The way they came out with their tasers. The way they treated the young men, too. Oscar and the young men. And it also talks about how after Oscar was murdered, his friends, five of his friends were detained, and they were detained for 6 hours in handcuffs, and that was way too long.
They were in handcuffs for 6 hours?
6 hours. I know my two sons were in handcuffs for 6 hours and three other young men, and then they were left in the cars for 2 hours too, handcuffed.
And This is right after the murder of Oscar Grant.
Right after
they seen their homeboy cold-bloodedly murdered in front of their face.
Correct. And they were screaming and hollering for them to call an ambulance, in which Tony Peroni was hollering at them, from what I believe, from what I've heard from the reports, that he was telling them to shut the fuck up. He's not calling, excuse me for saying, shut the F up. I'm not calling nobody.
And Tony Peroni is one of the other officers that were involved on the platform that night. Can you speak to the resignation of Tom Orloff, the district attorney of Alameda County, who recently has resigned?
I'm confused on that one. I don't know if he resigned from the pressure, or if this was something that was in the makings, or was it?
Well, it sure is a cold coincidence.
Yeah, you know, or maybe he doesn't want to be the first DA to send a police officer to trial for murder. I don't know.
Right.
That's what I was hearing, you know, that he didn't want to be the first DA to send, you know, a police officer on trial for murder.
How do you feel as a father, as someone who, you know, spent a lot of time with Oscar Grant, but also your two sons, who very well could have been shot by these same two police officers? How do you feel when basically it's being entertained that they're trying to move the venue for the trial?
Every time I see that video, you know, it's really disturbing, you know, to see all those young men, you know, to what they had to go through. And as a father, seeing your two sons, you know, being assaulted, especially my oldest son, who was assaulted by Johannes Mesley before he murdered Oscar Grant. You know, watching him just, you know, punching on my son, then handcuff him, and then go to Oscar Grant. And next thing you know, Oscar was murdered. You know, life hasn't been the same since January 1st. You know, and man, it's hard, you know, because, you know, Oscar and them young men were tight. And, you know, like you say, it could have been easily my son or any of the other young men, you know, but it was like, you know, he chose Oscar, you know. And it's like, man, it's so unfair, you know, especially to his mother, you know.
In Berkeley, I'm Amanda Bellerby. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Rod Coronado was already one of North America's most notorious radical environmentalists when he launched Operation Biteback, an all-out flame war on fur farming and animal research that left a trail of burned-out buildings across the country and made Rod the object of an intense FBI manhunt. He was known as the man who freed the animals. Part of the legacy of the Animal Liberation Front and Earth Liberation Front campaigns that Coronado spearheaded in the 1990s is a very high-profile legal battle, whether or not to prosecute radical environmental activists and other activists as quote-unquote terrorists. It's called the Green Scare by civil rights lawyers, and so far, the activists are losing. Some of them are losing big. My guest is Dean Kuypers. He writes for the LA Times and many magazines, and his latest book is Operation Biteback, Rod Coronado's War to Save American Wilderness. Dean Kuypers, welcome to Flashpoints and Pacifica Radio.
Thank you, Amanda. Appreciate it.
It's great to have you with us. Dean, you've known Rod Coronado since the early 90s. You also knew Judy Berry. You were there reporting on Redwood Summer in Northern California, and you've just had unparalleled access to this circle of activists. But how did that work in Rod's case? I mean, well, it's pretty amazing that any journalist would be trusted with information about an unsolved, unprosecuted crime wave of arsons and liberating all those animals from labs and fur farms.
You know, I wrote a big piece about him in 1995 for Rolling Stone. We went through a lot of this material at that time that became this book, but what I still didn't know in 1995 was that he was the guy who had burned all this stuff. So Rod and I had a weird sort of relationship in that he couldn't tell me everything. He was lying to me. And for his own protection, and then because it was sealed by the, you know, the government and so forth, and he wasn't supposed to talk about it. It was only until he was out of jail and many years afterwards that he said, okay, you know, I can finally tell you the whole story. And, of course, I was gobsmacked, as they say, to hear the extent of what had gone on here. He would do everything except name the names, because he had many unindicted co-conspirators who worked with him on these campaigns. And much to his credit, he was very, very good about giving people pseudonyms, and he would stick to the pseudonyms, and he would never slip. So all I have in my notes is pseudonyms. He trusted me. Also, I think the people in the movement know that I've always been a mainstream reporter. Los Angeles Times, or Spin, Rolling Stone, or Playboy. I'd do it for the front page of the New York Times if I could. For instance, Redwood Summer. Like, no one covered it. The mainstream media just didn't cover it. And that's a shame, and this is where a lot of exciting activism is happening, and someone ought to be on this stuff.
Let's go back to the beginning. Tell us about the Icelandic whaling ships and Rod's relationship with Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd.
Sure. That's where Rodney's story starts. Of course, the Sea Shepherds are well known to everyone suddenly because of their immensely popular show, Whale Wars, on Animal Planet now. But when Rod was only 12 years old, he sent money to the Sea Shepherds for gasoline for one of their anti-seal hunt campaigns up in Newfoundland. Good chunk of money. It was like $200 or something, paper route money or lawn mowing money or something. Paul Watson sent him a note back, a personal note saying, thank you so much for this. That's incredibly generous, et cetera. And Rod felt good about that because he had never gotten any kind of response from any of the other groups that he had tried to support. On a trip with his family, directly after graduating from high school, a graduation trip, they were up in Vancouver and, by design or not, ran across the boats. He literally got off the trip and got on the boat and said, Mom and Dad, I'm going to join right now. And Paul said, I'll put you to work today. And he joined. So he was on the Sea Shepherd from that point on. He didn't go to college. He just went straight to Sea Shepherd. About a year later, he was 19 or 20 years old. He went to Iceland with another Sea Shepherd member, and they watched the whaling fleet, which was four boats for Iceland. Rod and this other fellow watched the boats for about a month, figured out which ones were empty, and went out in the dead of night and sank two of them in the harbor, and then got on a plane and left the country. And Sea Shepherd called the next day and said, we sank the boats, come get us. And of course, since they were whaling under very controversial circumstances, they did nothing about it. And this all happened in 1986. So that was really a reputation maker for Rod Coronado. But at that point, he was, you know, one of the most famous activists on the planet for that action.
In all of these actions, and there were many, nobody was ever hurt, not even Rod. Can you talk about his commitment to nonviolence?
The Iceland experience is exactly the kind of thing that we should talk about in that context, because he sank the boats. The boats were empty. They were sure they were empty. They searched them from stem to stern beforehand. For him, that was the ultimate expression of Gandhian nonviolent direct action, in that he destroyed the property that was destroying life. Obviously, that's a very controversial position. Rod went on to make that, you know, one of the tenets of every action he did from that point on, to preserve life and to save animals and to not harm any living thing. So even when he was doing the arsons, he was going to every extreme to try to make sure that nobody was hurt. And several of the actions, which no one would have ever known about, were aborted because there simply was no way to do it, you know, quote unquote, safely. Now, of course, that's a controversial position. Paul Watson, who, of course, was one of Rod's mentors, Dave Foreman, who is the founder of Earth First, and many other people who were heroes to Rod, could not back his position on arson. You can't control it. You don't know that a firefighter is not going to get hurt responding to that fire. Fires can spread, etc. The movement really didn't go with him on that one. But Rod, you know, continued, and much to his credit, no one was ever hurt. Since the Department of Justice has been keeping records on this kind of action, there have been over 1,200 acts attributed to groups like the Sea Shepherd and to Animal Liberation Front, Earth Liberation Front, and about $1 billion worth of damage, which, you know, of course, only Rod was only responsible for a small percentage of that. And hardly any of those people have ever been caught, and no one has ever been hurt.
Okay, what was Operation Biteback, and who were Rod's targets?
Operation Biteback was pretty unique for what it was. Rod went after the fur industry and specifically mink farmers in the United States. There was about 600 farms, but they were highly dependent on a mink farmers research foundation, which solved nutrition problems and breeding problems and stuff for the mink industry. Rod saw that maybe that was the weak link, and he went after them because that was a very small group of researchers, maybe only 5-10 people in the whole country. And he went after their labs, mostly at universities, and would break into their labs and set big fires and burn them out.
Talk about CAF, the Coalition Against Fur Farms. Rod also had another group. He really led a double life, kind of Clark Kent and Superman figure. And he was the spokesperson for these actions, and he was also undercover. Can you talk about his many identities during that time?
Sure. It's totally fascinating. It would make for a great movie. Operation Bite Back was being attributed to and claimed by the Animal Liberation Front. I was reporting on it at the time, and my contact for the Animal Liberation Front was Rod Coronado. But I didn't know he was also the arsonist. So there's one double life. He's actually doing this stuff at night, getting like 15 minutes of sleep, and then running around to, you know, every media outlet he knew in that town and like delivering communiques that he said were delivered to him anonymously from the Animal Liberation Front, which is totally amazing. I mean, obviously he's painting a big bullseye on his back, and that's why they did get him for that eventually. But also at the same time, he had just come off that global investigations work with Jonathan Paul, where he had filmed the neck breaking. He decided that what he would do for those minks, since he had not intervened in their deaths, was that he would buy everything else that was alive on that farm, all the equipment, all the animals, 60 minks, 4 bobcats and 2 lynx, and trucked them to the Olympic Peninsula in Washington and rehabbed them over about a 6-month period, taught them all how to hunt live food again, released them all to the wild. And so some of the time in 1990 and 91, when he was appearing in public, he was also appearing as a spokesman for CAF. He was even having a double and triple life just around the CAF, the Coalition Against Fur Farms group, because when he was making a statement as an environmentalist, and remember that Rod is very well known at this point, everybody knows who he is and knows his face, he's Rod Coronado from CAF, but when in his correspondence with fur farmers and stuff, he was passing himself off as Jim Perez from the Country Air Fur Farm, which was CAF.
The same acronym.
The same acronym. It was totally unsustainable what he was doing, because he was appearing as Jim Perez. He was appearing on TV sometimes as the guy from CAF. Then he was appearing as a guy who's a spokesman for Animal Liberation Front. And meanwhile, he's in every town where these fires were happening. I mean, it was pretty clear to any casual observer that he was involved somehow in all of this stuff. But much to his credit, I guess as a criminal, he didn't leave any evidence. And I was in the same boat. Even when we finally did an in-person interview in April of 92, pretty late in the game, I still didn't know for sure that it was him.
Well, your book, Dean Kuiper's Operation Bite Back, is a blistering read. You just can't put it down. Some of these people eventually got caught, though, including Rod. And they're being called terrorists now. They've faced potential sentences of life plus 1,000 years. So what happened?
Partly around Operation Bite Back in 1992, Congress passed the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, created a crime of domestic terrorism for property damage. And so that changed the whole definition of terrorism, because up till that point, it was about attacking people, like flying an airplane into a building and killing 3,000 people. That's terrorism. And then, of course, much later, 2006, they passed the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which kind of finally put some teeth into that protection act. So there's been this great leap in the definition of terrorism. And the consequences could not be more weird and terrible for everyone, not just environmentalists and animal rights folks, because now so many acts can be considered as terrorist acts. It's infringed really directly on stuff that we used to call free speech and that we used to call nonviolent civil disobedience. And other sentences increased as well. And, you know, after 9/11, with an influx of anti-terrorism money and a newfound purpose in fanning out through the country to try to see what kind of domestic terrorists they could shake out of the trees. Department of Justice wasn't having much success in busting the Animal Liberation Front, Earth Liberation Front nexus until really this fascinating Eugene case that you reference here that everybody kind of calls the core, Green Scare case, where they got, you know, a drug addict. They got Jake Ferguson making a drug deal and said, hey, we're going to make it tough on you. And he had a little kid, and he really didn't want to go to jail because his old man had spent all his life in jail. And they got Ferguson to wear a wire and just tore the movement to shreds, because even if people said one little teeny thing about how they may have been involved or acknowledged or a head nod or whatever they did on tape, to acknowledge that they even had any knowledge that people were out doing nefarious things at night, they got scooped up. And then they applied these heavy, heavy sentences to coerce cooperation out of everybody. And the sentences are just, they're just jaw-dropping. They're just mammoth. There were two people who were the lookouts on one non-injury arson who at one point, the sentence that was thrown around for them was life plus 1,115 years. They're also now in the beginning stages of making the first prosecution using the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. So we're going to hear a lot more terrorism sentences and a lot more terrorism prosecutions, I think, before all of this gets rolled back.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. A new report documents a trail of human rights violations against immigrants guilty by immigration status. And it gets into what we have known about and have been talking about for some time, but it's more documentary evidence that there is a war that has been unleashed by the federal government and their surrogates against some of the millions of people who do the hardest work in this country, immigrant workers, their families, their friends. Joining us to talk about this new report is somebody who's been on it for some time, Arnaldo Garcia. Arnaldo Garcia works with the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Arnaldo, welcome back to Flashpoints. Good to have you with us. Give us a thumbnail sketch of what we learned in this report.
One is that, for example, high-profile raids, which everybody's familiar with, where they come heavily armed with helicopters many times and buses and cart away hundreds of workers, is not actually the way the majority of immigrants are being detained and deported. That high-profile raids were about 2% of the overall number of people that are deported. For example, last year, almost 400,000 people got deported. Only around 6,000 were done through raids. So we're missing, 394,000 people. So how are they doing it? So they've built up over the last almost 10 years an incredible array of prisons, private prisons as well. County and local and state and federal jails are being used to house immigrants. For example, the Pew Hispanic Fund reported last year that 75% of all Latinos who are in federal prisons are in there solely because they're undocumented. And federal prisons only represent 6% of the total. So if we start looking at local, county, and state jails and also private prisons, we get a horrendous picture of what's happening in our communities, where families are being devastated, people are being separated, people are being disappeared in the hundreds of thousands. So any given day right now, they have the capacity to hold up to 40,000 people per day. So last year, they held about 700,000 people in prison and deported around 400,000.
All right, now, let's go back to that missing number. How many people, when you say missing, how many people are missing, and what do you mean by that?
Well, how are they able to process 400,000 people? And we only really know about 6,000 of them.
You know about the 6,000 of 400,000.
Yeah. Yeah, because we hear about the high-profile raids. Like last year, right, the two major ones were in Postville, Iowa, right, and in Laurel, Mississippi. In Postville, they deported around 398 workers, and they spent over $5 million to do that. And they rounded up the workers, and they put them on a cattle fairgrounds, and they brought in interpreters, and it was like a high-speed assembly line, just plead guilty, here it is, and you're out. They were being charged with felony ID theft. And so they were able to hold people without having them access to lawyers, and
these were like moms separated from their kids, yeah, being charged with these felonies, and
mothers, fathers, teenagers, minors who shouldn't be working but are in really at that point it was a kosher meat factory.
Right.
And they spent over $13,000 per person to deport them. And you find out about that because one of the interpreters broke the silence. It got published in the New York Times at that time. The same thing happened in Laurel, Mississippi. Mississippi is not a large, it's like the Bay Area. If you see the police amassing, arms, men with arms, you know something's going to happen, right? And they made a raid against a factory. And in both cases, right, in other cases as well, the underlying thing is happening is that there's a labor dispute happening, and they bring in the ICE to
get rid of their workforce and get a cheaper workforce.
Yeah.
But you're saying that's a small number, and that there are close to 400,000 people who we don't know where they are. And that, I guess, includes moms separated, families broken up.
Yeah, children being stolen from women, putting up for adoption at birth. Children, like there was just even a case that happened about a week ago that a woman posing as an ICE agent came and abducted a kid, a baby from a mother, right, and did it under threat. So there's all these things that are happening, horrible things that are happening because the federal government has laws on the books that gives a perception that people who maybe don't speak English or maybe don't look white have less or don't have the similar or have no rights at all. So when President Obama used in his speech illegal immigrant, that was such a cave in to the whole problem of racism. Right. So when someone is illegal, right, people think you can do anything you want to them. Employers exploit the hell out of them. Landlords rent them and harass them and rob them. They don't have services. Families are working 2-3 jobs. They never see the children. The children, you know, there's a whole process of criminalization that's taking place. So we have a really big basic fundamental crisis in our communities, and nobody gets out free out of this because it affects everybody.
Well, now let's talk about there's a whole infrastructure of imprisonment now that is growing up around this, if you will, refugee business, this immigrant, illegal alien business. And that's, of course, the expanding private prison system that makes big money. Treating moms and their kids and whole families and people who are workers as hardened criminals.
Yeah, and it has a name. It's a plan. It was begun in 2003. It's called Operation Endgame. And if you look at Operation Endgame, and if you go to our report, you can open the link to it. It's a plan by ICE, and it basically was to triple the number of interior enforcement agents, build the capacity that they have achieved now of 40,000 people per day. And double the border patrol.
You mean they're taking 40,000 a day now?
Yes. Any given day, they have space up to 40,000 people per day right now as we're speaking. And the only thing they have special initiatives like on the border, they have this thing called Operation Streamline. You might remember that the previous Department of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, used to call it, we have to end the catch and release policy. Now, what is catch and release? Catch and release is what we would call due process rights. He was saying we have to end the due process rights of all these category of people and send them straight to jail. And the first-time offenders, if you caught the first time, you can, and you're almost automatically convicted, you get up to a 6-month sentence, and then you're deported. If you come back the second time, you get caught, it's up to a 2-year sentence. A third time, it's up to a 10-year conviction. So right now, we have people reporting us that have been there 3, 5, 8 years already in prison for being undocumented. Nothing else. They haven't robbed, killed, raped, stolen, hurt anybody. They haven't, and they're in prison just because they're undocumented. And that's a really major development in our society. And it's a really big threat to the rest of us because they're not dealing with a separate set of rights. You know, there's not a double standard here. There's only one standard. It's the Constitution. And the Constitution has been eroded over the last 29 years, to put it very bluntly, right? And a lot of people have lost sight that when they're attacking the rights of immigrants, the rights of the foreign-born, they're really attacking the rights of citizens because there's only one standard. So people who are political activists, people who defend human rights, people who defend the rights of immigrant workers, of day laborers, that's a big threat to our own rights to be able to do and express ourselves as we are doing right now in KPFA.
Speaking with Arnaldo Garcia, we're talking about a troubling new report that gets into the treatment of immigrants, undocumented workers, and it's apparently under Obama, more open season. The report is called Guilty by Immigration Status. And give me some examples, Arnaldo, about what has happened when private prisons have taken over.
Because private prisons, their goal is a profit. You know,
keep them in, make money.
What you have is people being served rotten food, barely of any health care. A lot of brutality by the guards who are not trained and have the same perception that everybody has, that they're immigrants, they're illegal, they have no rights, we can do anything we want to them. And right now, over the last 6 months, there's been two uprisings in Texas. Right now, there's an ongoing hunger strike.
Tell us about that.
Because they're complaining because of the lack of adequate health care, the access to legal resources, you know, representation, people languishing, people actually asking to be either deported or taken out of their, sent anywhere but the prison.
And this is a private prison in Texas. Is this the Correction Corporation of America?
Yes, yeah, the CCA. CCA runs about almost half of all the federal detention facilities for immigrants. They have them in Texas. There's the other notorious ones is Reeves County, where there was an uprising where the immigrants or the people who were in jail were saying one of our the pattern is that when somebody complains that they need health care or they're sick, they get put in isolation. In the case of Reeves County, which is in Pecos, Texas, there was a death in December. And the prisoners had been asking for health for this person, and that person, instead of being taken to the hospital, was put in an isolation unit. And they began an uprising. They saw the body taken out and being taken out from that he was dead. So they led an uprising, and then the guards locked him in and threw tear gas. A fire was started, and they had to crawl out of the prison for their lives. And then they were left outside.
So they locked him
into the fire. And then they were left outside for a couple of weeks in the open air, maybe getting one meal of it all a day and with no blankets, no nothing. And this is the situation we're finding, right? And this is the cases we know of because there's a lot of clamp down. When we filed the complaint in this case of Reeves, ICE and other people said, you have to take that down from your website because we're not responsible for that, even though ICE arrested and put all those people in that prison. It was the Bureau of Prisons in case of Reeves, right? Because that's who carries the contract. And there's approximately 16 large facilities like this. 8 of them are run privately and 8 publicly. And there's another 900 or so jails that are local county and state prisons where people are going directly from reporting a crime, and the person they reported and got convicted, that person goes through a year trial and goes to a federal prison. And then when the trial ends, they arrest the person who is the star witness and puts them in the same federal prison with the person helped convict, even though that other person didn't go through a process of any kind, wasn't charged. It was automatically, that's why we called it guilty by immigration status. People are going directly from their houses, either being dumped in Tijuana or being arrested in Sacramento and ended up in Florence at the detention center there, being shipped around, trying to be broken down and being put in really horrible conditions. And the conditions on the inside of the prisons are very reflective of the conditions that they're facing outside in the communities in terms of workplace exploitation, the severe non-existent or cutbacks in services, the attacks that are happening not just in the labor and the work site, but also against women particularly. There's a pattern emerging, right, where the immigrant women or women who are perceived to be immigrants, many times they're indigenous women who are losing their children or being separated, being deported, their children being left and being put up for adoption. And a judge says, well, that parent is negligent because she is an illegal. And this is why they're charging people. It's just an incredible situation.
And when you say, Arnaldo, when you say that some 400,000 people are missing in this horrible process, you're also talking about a lot more people who have been hurt, undermined in terms of their families, their friends, where they've been. So this really affects millions of people.
It affects millions of people. You're right. Here, for example, in California, 1 out of every 4 persons is an immigrant, including Schwarzenegger. And the undocumented community might be 1 out of every 8. So, and many families, if not most of our families and our neighbors, we're a mixed status. You know, we have citizens, we have legal permanent residents, we have undocumented people, we have people visiting. So when you start attacking the fiber, the weavings, the social, the cultural fabric of our society like that, where they take children, mothers, men, fathers, grandparents, elderly, they don't discriminate. They take babies. There was even a jail for families where they were doing biometric scans. And they had prison uniforms for the babies, and it was
they had prison uniforms
for the babies. And it was recently closed, but a lot of people said it's a victory. They closed the, what's it called, the one in Texas?
Styles by
the
Barnaby,
Hutto,
huh?
The ICE called the Hutto Family Unity Center.
The Family Unity.
Yeah, they called that they believe in Family Unity. And
that sounds like a little bit Nazi-ish.
Yeah, it's more than Nazi. It's made in the U.S. But it's a horrible situation. It's a horrible situation. And the thing is, like, when you hear us talking like this, we say we have to restore due process rights for every person. We have to protect the labor rights of every person. We have to demand that all the money. Last year, they spent over $1 billion to hold all these people in jail to deport them. $1 billion. What could our communities do with $1 billion? We could build schools, housing, health care.
Healthcare,
all these things, right? And the Border Patrol, they're spending almost $3 billion a year as well to militarize the border. And that's the figures we know, because it's very hard to see there's a lot of lack of transparency and accountability. The 2010 budget has already been signed, and it includes all these big increases. They're introducing these new initiatives like secure communities, which makes it easier for the police. It'll make it easier for Joe Arpaio, the notorious sheriff of Phoenix, Arizona. It'll make it easier for Sheriff Joe Arpaio to do what he's doing now than through the 287G program.
So he should, stock up on some more pink underwear that he can degrade hundreds and thousands of people with the support of the federal government. We don't have a lot of time.
Right.
And there's one other point I want to hit. And when you did your litany and you talked about health care, I have to say that it is absolutely shocking to me that Obama now has adopted an aggressive policy in assuring he doesn't have to be asked anymore. He can't wait to tell you that these illegal aliens aren't going to get health care.
Yeah, he has made it very clear, right, because of the coalition or compact that he is involved in, right, and that's where it begins, right? They're planning on adopting the Massachusetts model. And what happened in Massachusetts is that they knocked off the healthcare rolls, 30,000 residents, legal permanent residents who are immigrants. So if you can imagine some of the plans they have, that they're negotiating away our rights. They're not negotiating away, you know, the corporations' rights, the healthcare insurance industry's rights. No, they're negotiating away our rights, because it's going to affect us all. The reason around how civil liberties, for example, is linked to this in the healthcare proposal that's being negotiated is that they're going to require identification. And you might have to register in order to get whatever they might offer that might be a pittance to begin with. And that's where they'll be able to break us down, because whenever they've had employer sanctions, for example, on the books since 1986, and who do they discriminate against? They don't discriminate against white people or white workers. They discriminate against Latinos and Asians or anybody who looks or sounds foreign. So they might sneak in the healthcare proposal some things that already exist and make them worse for us. Maybe like a national worker ID card in order to be able, not just a social security card, but where you would have to register. And some of this stuff is very, very real. It's already in the books. It's being expanded. It's being institutionalized. And Obama on one level doesn't have to do anything to 2012, because that's when the Operation Endgame plan ends, when they're going to build up all this infrastructure. And the Operation Endgame plan says, we're going to deport everyone who can be deported. That's the mission statement, Operation Endgame, to build the infrastructure for that. So our thing is that we have to build the infrastructure for us to assert our rights, expand them, change the way citizenship is, that it includes everybody who lives together, not necessarily pays taxes, because you can't start a hierarchy saying, well, do you pay taxes or not? Our rights are our rights. It doesn't matter if we contribute or benefit anybody. We have rights.
All right. Arnaldo Garcia, working with the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, the new report that documents a horrifying trail of human rights violations, guilty by immigration status. How do people get this and get more information here?
You can go right to our website, which is www.nnirr.org, and you'll see it on the left side. You can click it on the left side for right now. It's not completely posted on the very front of the screen, but it's up.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.